What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to our podcast here at the New Books Network. This is your host, Steven Siegel, coming to you from San Diego today. And my guest for New Books Eastern European Studies today is Larry Wolf. Larry Wolf has written a new book. It's called Woodrow Wilson and the Reimagining of Eastern Europe, published by Stanford University Press in 2020. Welcome, Larry, to our podcast today.
Thanks very much, Stephen.
Now, I want to begin with a couple of questions about this particular book. So, Larry, can you introduce perhaps why you decided to write a book on Woodrow Wilson? What are your motivations for this?
So, you know, Stephen, I've been interested for a long time in ideas about Eastern Europe, especially Western ideas about Eastern Europe. I know you are as well. And the focus of my research initially was the 18th century. I'm a Dieswijkemist by training. 25 years ago, I wrote a book called Inventing Eastern Europe, which argued that the Western philosophers invented Eastern Europe, synthesized it conceptually in their writings about the region. And I have been long contemplating the possibility of bringing some of these ideas to bear on the 20th century, in part because I lived through the latter half of the 20th century and saw Eastern Europe, you know, completely transformed during my own academic lifetime. And I was interested in trying to write a little bit about what happened in the 20th century. And I guess with the passing of the 20th century and our entrance into the 21st century, I began to feel that it was no longer off limits to me as history territory. And I started to think about 20th century ideas about Eastern Europe and the role they played in its political transformations. And I came to Wilson in part because he's a titanic figure when it comes to thinking about Eastern Europe, but also because we were moving through a whole series of centennials, beginning with the centennial of the outbreak of the First World War and perhaps culminating in the centennial last year, 2019, of the Treaty of Versailles. And that whole centennial way of thinking put me in mind of Wilson and the outsized role that he played. And that's what brought me to it. I would say it's a project that was initially meant to follow up on an article that was published in the Journal of Modern History that dealt with the ways in which Western writers wrote about Eastern Europe in 1911, 1912, 1913. I was then going to launch myself into the World War I period. And the Wilson project just turned out to be so large that I felt that I needed to write a small book about it. I might originally have imagined it as a chapter in a larger book about Eastern Europe, but it really took over my life for several years.
Yeah, and I think in looking at the structure of the book, because you've divided it into four chapters, that there really is a changing understanding of Eastern Europe. You actually write toward the end of your introduction that the map of Eastern Europe today still reflects Wilson's problematic preoccupation with delineating an interlocking complex of national states, and its origins can be traced in the intellectual history of Wilson's writings and thoughts as they emerged from the cultural context of mental mapping during and after World War I. So here I have two questions. First, what do you mean by the intellectual history of Wilson's writings and thoughts? Who is your Woodrow Wilson? And then secondly, what is the cultural context of mental mapping from, say, 1914 to 1919?
So in terms of an intellectual history of Wilson, I was really not trying to write a political history or a diplomatic history of Wilson, though that inevitably forms the backdrop of what I'm doing. I was interested in what was going on in his mind, what his thoughts were about Eastern Europe, how those thoughts got there, and how they produced what I would call a mental map for Wilson of a region that he never visited. And in a way, and I experienced some of this with Inventing Eastern Europe as well, writing about the 18th century. It's a very pure work of intellectual history, since Wilson never sets foot in the region. His ideas about Eastern Europe are, ideas in their purest form. There's no empirical eyewitness experience of the territories that he did so much to transform. So that, in some ways, seemed to me to make it a perfect intellectual history project. And that's the kind of historian I am. I'm interested in writing about ideas, mentalities, and cultural contexts. If we were thinking about the cultural context for Wilson, what it would mean to think of this as a cultural history, it's on the one hand, I would say a cultural history of a certain sort of American naivete with respect to Europe, in which World War I provides the kind of engagement that then demands instant experience, instant knowledge. Wilson's a sort of model for thinking that way, because I would say that Wilson is someone who thought very, very little about Eastern Europe up until 1917, up until the moment that America entered World War I. And over the course of the next 2 years, gives himself a crash course in which he attempts to learn as much as he can about the region. So in that sense, the cultural context is one of American naivete and American self-education, Wilson's self-education with respect to Eastern Europe. But of course, there's also a broader cultural context of American and European knowledge about the region. I've thought about this a little bit, and especially in relation to academic knowledge. And your work has actually been really helpful to me in thinking about the academic foundations of cartography in the period. But if you look across Europe, in Germany, in Britain, in France, as well as in America, you can see the beginnings of an academic structuring of knowledge that focuses on Eastern Europe in the early 20th century. And one of the things that I think is super interesting about Wilson's self-education is that it both draws on those early academic foundations of Eastern Europe, and then actually provides an enormous impetus to the further development of those of the academic study of Eastern Europe.
Yeah, and thank you. I think we do share this preoccupation with mental maps and mental mapping. I remember as a graduate student being inspired by Inventing Eastern Europe and reading your book, really thoroughly and thinking also when we were just publishing Venison, the Slavs. So my next question has to do with where your story begins, maybe even where your opera begins. I know you're a great fan of opera. The mental maps, as you describe them, are a lot about fantasy and a kind of cultural subconscious. You describe mental maps at one point as imagistic, impressionistic, idiosyncratic maps in the human mind. So where do you start the story of Wilson, let's say, in contrast to a lot of the political biographers in an American vein?
So for me, there are a couple of points in Wilson's biography that are interesting to think about as the prehistory that's really essential for understanding his encounter with the region during the war. The first is one that I signal almost immediately in the book, and it's his engagement as a student with Gladstone. We know this about Wilson, that Gladstone is one of his political heroes. This is the great British liberal leader. But I think that, and it's a sense of filiation that makes sense. That is to say, Gladstone is a Christian liberal with a capital L, and that actually fits Wilson very nicely. The righteousness of Gladstone, for better or for worse, also characterizes Wilson and his political style. But one of the things that I found, and it's something that there's not actually a lot of documentation of, but there's just enough documentation to make the case, is that Wilson, as a Princeton student in the 1870s, was following Gladstone closely, which means that he was following the Eastern Crisis of the 1870s. And one of the things that you find if you begin to look at the Wilson papers is that his earliest assumptions about Eastern Europe are based on a Turkophobia that's clearly inherited from the Eastern Crisis of the 1870s, and Gladstone's righteousness about the Ottoman Empire is expressed in the famous Bulgarian Horrors pamphlet. So that was one piece of Wilson's early life that I wanted to try to bring to bear on his understanding of Eastern Europe during World War I. And I would say that the conventional literature on Wilson has been, to the extent that it's focused on the region, has been focused on Wilson and the Habsburg monarchy. And the Ottoman Empire is usually considered as a separate and secondary issue for Wilson. I thought that it was interesting to think about this a little bit in reverse. That is to say that Wilson is someone who comes to the war with strong early preconceptions about the Ottoman Empire, and it's the development of those ideas that eventually begin to shape his perspective on the Habsburg monarchy. I should say that when I say the conventional literature focuses on Wilson and the Habsburg monarchy, there's not actually a whole lot of conventional literature that does that. One of the things that surprised me considerably when I started to think about this is that Wilson, who's the subject of an enormous literature and a lot of recent publications that focus on, say, Wilson and the wider world. Manella's Wilsonian Moment is a brilliant book that does precisely that, that thinks about Wilson and the colonial world in Asia, in Africa. And I was a little surprised that Eastern Europe had received pretty little attention over the course of recent decades. And there hadn't been a major book focused on precisely that since Mamete's study from the 1950s. That is to say, the discussion of this almost dates back to people who lived through the world of the peace conference. And it seemed to me that it was time to try to, cast a fresh eye on Wilson and Eastern Europe. So the first piece of the Wilson biography that I wanted to try to bring to bear on this study was this early engagement with Gladstone and through Gladstone, the Eastern Question. The second piece, if I can continue for just a minute,
sure, please,
is Wilson's early childhood in Confederate Virginia, and what it meant for Wilson to think about race, because race is a word that's used pretty casually in Wilson's writings about Eastern Europe. He sees it as a region of multiple races. You and I know that the word race is used very casually and sometimes signifies race as we understand it, but sometimes signifies ethnicity and nationality as we would now understand it in the early 20th century. I'm a little interested in the way that those categories bleed into one another in Wilson's writing, and in particular, his preoccupation with the unmixing of races in Eastern Europe, that is to say, the sorting of nations into national states, seemed to me interesting in relation to his early Virginia Confederate childhood, and perhaps most of all, his rhetorical formulation of the war as a war of emancipation seemed to me interesting as a Lincoln-esque preoccupation. One of the things that, again, I feel has, you know, barely been noted is that the Wilson presidency coincides precisely with the building of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington. And I was interested in trying to think through Wilson's relationship to Lincoln when Wilson sees himself as a man who's waging a war of emancipation.
Yeah, and you actually have a section, which I think is absolutely fascinating, called Like the Voice of Lincoln. And I never would have thought of the way that you draw back into American history, especially the postbellum history, and then reflect to Voltaire. It's not just about Gladstonian Turkophobia or outrage from the 1870s, but I'm really interested in this longer trajectory that you draw with the project of enlightenment and with some of the major thinkers, both in the American and in the European context. What I want to ask about, to take it beyond Wilson, is who is his supporting cast? Now, you mentioned quite rightly that he has very little empirical experience. He's in fact never visited beyond London and Paris. He purports to speak for peoples he probably has never encountered, except maybe on the campaign trail. So how to resolve that? He is actually becoming the spokesman, like Voltaire and Rousseau and Lincoln too, for millions of people. How do you get at that?
So there are, I would say there are several different pieces here. One, which you've already alluded to on the campaign trail, is Wilson's relationship to the East European immigrant communities in the United States. He needs them, right? They're useful and important to him, and they therefore have the possibility of lobbying him a little bit over the course of the wartime years, and they do that. Wilson, however, tends to regard these immigrant groups with some reserve, right? He knows that they are politically necessary to him, but his own patrician perspective on the immigrant communities is something that comes across, say, pretty clearly in his History of America, published in the early 20th century. And it's not a flattering perspective. But it's one open door in the White House for people who want to talk to him about Eastern Europe, would be representatives of immigrant groups. The second piece of this is connected to personal friendships that he strikes up with self-appointed East European political leaders who are present in America during the war. And he meets with both Masaryk and Paderewski, who are both really interesting to him and whom he feels he has a special friendship and relationship with, and will continue to feel that for the rest of his life. He dies early in the 1920s, in the mid-20s, soon after leaving office, as you know. There's a sentimental piece to Wilson's viewing of Eastern Europe, in which he views it through certain particular friendships, which become for him metonymies that allow him to see himself as the friend to an entire nation. It's something that you see a lot of in the Wilsonian discussion of the late war years and then the early peace years. The idea of Wilson as the friend of Czechoslovakia, that I say his friendship for Masaryk makes him a friend to the entire country. And Wilson himself is very taken with this idea of his friendship for whole peoples, who in turn reciprocate that friendship and have, have reciprocal sentimental feelings for him. So that would be the second piece, Wilson's cultivation of the friendship for particular individuals from the region, and then his sense of having a friendship for whole communities, for whole nations from the region. And finally, the third piece, which again touches on your work, is the inquiry piece. There is created for Wilson in 1917 by his close confidant and advisor, Colonel Edward House, a research group called The Inquiry, directed by Sidney Mezes, the president of City College in New York, including the young journalist Walter Lippmann, but also including both academics and figures from the world of cartography, because Wilson is super interested in having the inquiry collect maps for him, that will educate the president about Eastern Europe, will prepare papers for him about different parts of the region, about the different peoples of the region. And there's actually a mobilization of academic knowledge for the briefing of the president in beginning in 1917 and moving right through the team that he, the very large team of advisors he takes with him to the peace conference, including Isaiah Bowman, who you write about in such an interesting way in your book, Map Men. So the mobilization of academic knowledge is the third piece and one that's really interesting to me. Wilson is often faulted for wanting to be the star of the peace conference all by himself. That is to say, there are the delegation that he names probably should have included other high level people who, especially from the Republican Party, that is to say, his chances of getting the treaty approved would have been much greater had he included someone like Senator Lodge, who ends up sinking the treaty in the Senate. Had he included someone like former President Taft, or even former President Theodore Roosevelt, really large figures from American political life. He didn't want to take that chance. He didn't want to be upstaged in any way. He didn't want to have any rival figures of stature on the peace delegation. So in Paris, and he avoids that to his cost, ultimately, when it comes to trying to bring the treaty back home to the public and to the Senate. But he does actually bring a boatload of advisors, including academics of, considerable standing, who are there precisely to provide him with information about the regions that he himself has never seen and knows very little about and has never thought about before 1917.
Yeah, and of course, Bowman and House are responsible for rounding up all of the maps. Bowman is the chief territorial specialist. So, they're working at the headquarters of the American Geographical Society in 156th Street in New York. And they round up over 1,000 maps. I think it's something like 1,200 maps to bring with them to Paris. Do you have a good, I really have to ask this, but do you have a good impression of which of these experts, advisors, had the most influence? I've always been puzzled by this. You have such an interesting chapter with Archibald Carey Coolidge, for instance, who, you know, is a very important figure. Coolidge has a team of American informants, including a lot of military officers and academics who wind up in Eastern Europe. So what is the filter upwards to Wilson? You have a sense of it, but it's really hard to see who's sort of whispering in his ear. How do you get at that?
So Coolidge is not actually whispering in his ear. Coolidge is actually based in Vienna during most of the period of that the conference is taking place, although he comes to Paris later. He's providing reports from the field that Wilson is really interested in reading and interested in understanding. I would say that Coolidge's team plays a considerable role. And when I say a word, Coolidge is the Harvard professor who is most interested in Eastern Europe. He's actually done the traveling that Wilson never did. He's been to Russia. He's been to the Ottoman Empire. He's had an audience with the Tsar. He's seen the Ottoman Sultan. He knows German. He's familiar with Central Europe. He's someone who has a lot of knowledge of the region, of academic knowledge. And he's someone who actually introduces Slavic history at Harvard in the early 20th century, teaches a course on the history of Northern and Eastern Europe that, you know, begins the academic study of that area at Harvard, and who then brings his graduate students in on the Wilsonian project as well. They're his assistants as part in the inquiry. And they're also present in Europe during the peace conference. These would be Robert Kerner and Robert Howard Lord. Kerner, specialist on Czech stuff and South Slavic stuff. Lord, a Polonist who's, you know, very interested in Polish issues. I would say that in terms of having Wilson's ear, what the history experts are able to provide are cautions to Wilson. Wilson, you know, comes to Europe with a set of principles and a set of war aims that he believes are relatively straightforward. And the historians who fan out across the region and send reports to him are the ones who are cautioning him that it's not as straightforward as he thinks it is, that populations are mixed in a way that will make national self-determination pretty complicated on the ground. And Wilson listens to their cautions. He doesn't always take them into account. He doesn't always feel that he can take them into account. But you can see Wilson gradually appreciating as the conference, proceeds during those first 6 months of 2019, that all of these questions are more complicated than he thought he thought they would be. Say famously the 13th point on the creation of an independent Poland, on lands with indisputably Polish populations, right? The question of what those lands with indisputably Polish populations actually are is something that Wilson only comes to understand in its full complexity over the course of the peace conference itself. And it's someone like Lord who's trying to keep him informed of what that might actually mean on the ground in different parts of the regions that are claimed by the new Polish state. You'd probably have a better idea than I do of to what extent Bowman had Wilson's ear. I think that Bowman was always able to put a map in Wilson's hand. And one of the things that I, you know, thought about often, I mean, when I thought about you while I was working on this book, was, you know, we frequently see in the notes of the peace conference, Wilson with a map in his hand, right, addressing the Big Three or the Council of Four, and pointing at the map, which presumably Bowman put there, right, in his hand. But whether Bowman is actually shaping the way that he uses the map and the way that he reflects on the map is harder for me to say. I don't know what your impression is. My sense is that a lot of the advisors, did their best here, but found it a little frustrating to bring to bear their erudition on Wilson's actual negotiation at the peace conference. And I think Wilson himself found it a little frustrating at the peace conference to not be able to deal with these issues in their full complexity, but to feel that there was political and diplomatic pressure upon him all the time in order to, think politically about these issues rather than academically.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I really do agree with you in the Wilsonian friendship chapter about Wilson, because it seemed to me that he was so confident in his own rectitude, almost to the point of cocksureness. You have this part where you talk about his exchanges with Clemenceau and Lloyd George and Orlando. I didn't study the Italian aspect very well, but we're at the point where he's insisting to Orlando that plebiscite is the answer, and of course this doesn't work really well once you get onto the ground and start applying these a priori concepts. I think you've captured these exchanges very well with the great men of the Paris Peace Conference. They're very prickly exchanges with Clemenceau and I think equally with Lloyd George.
Or maybe even more so.
Yeah, definitely. And so Wilson is trying to apply these dynamics of friendship, but it becomes something like a cover up. It's moral rhetoric, but maybe correct me if I'm wrong. It becomes a vocabulary of trying to make things happen when they actually can't. Jessie Labow, in her book on transatlantic Central Europe, has a wonderful idea of the workaround. Like, if you can't solve a problem, you work around it, and then you hope to come back to it later. But of course, the conference is over after May, and so then they have done their best, which may not be good at all.
So I agree with you that the question of trying to on the one hand presents a sense of himself as the missionary savior of the region, and there's no doubt that Wilson has a messianic sense of what his role is at the Paris Peace Conference, and there are plenty of other people to confirm him in that sense of himself during the peace conference. And at the same time, to create a settlement that works on the ground, and to do him justice, he does engage with the details of what it means to create a settlement that would work on the ground. But it's very hard to square that circle. That is to say, on the one hand, to be a messiah, and on the other hand, to work with the dirty details of the settlement. And Wilson is constantly moving between those two registers, and I feel it's a little bit, you can feel the awkwardness and incongruousness of it for him when you read the transcripts of the peace conference discussions. The plebiscites, I thought were totally fascinating, and Wilson's ideas about them are changing and evolving. And again, this is with response to what his team in the field is telling him, right? His experts, he's listening to them. He loves the idea of plebiscites. And one of the things that interested me was Wilson coming out of the progressive movement in the United States comes from a political movement that's really interested in the power of the referendum. And Wilson is therefore deeply interested in whether that can be applied to national self-determination in Europe, the referendum. But he's made aware of how complicated it is to make referendums meaningful on the ground. And I actually enjoyed writing about this at a moment when referendums were such touchy issues in our own life, in our own lives and times. That is to say, I was writing about this through the moment of the Brexit referendum and at a moment when we were, all very, very aware of how touchy, difficult, volatile, referendums could be, this supremely democratic form, which at the same time gives all kinds of encouragement to undemocratic forces in politics. So that was very much on my mind as I was writing. Wilson attempting to think through the usefulness of referenda for producing fair settlements. The other thing that really interested me, and I, ended up writing a whole chapter about it, and I'm a little surprised that there hasn't been more attention to this in the Wilson literature, is what I would call the invention of minority rights at the conference.
Right. You're right about that. Yeah.
And Wilson's gradual realization that it is the flip side of national self-determination, and that if national self-determination is implicitly about national majorities, then it must also incorporate some dimension of minority rights. And I see that as one of the, brilliantly innovative Wilsonian conceptions at the peace conference, but at the same time, one that's, far more prickly than he himself appreciates when he attempts to bring it to bear on the settlement.
Well,
I interrupted you.
Yeah, no, that's a perfect segue into the Polish question. Could you share your story and thoughts about minority rights in the context of the chapter where you're writing about Paderewski's pomposity and staginess, and you have a wonderful story of a goat herd. I think our listeners would be interested in this. I mean, how do you get at the Polish question? Let's say we've got, the federalism of Piłsudski, we've got the anti-Semitism of Dmowski, we have the changing Wilsonian attitude. He becomes very, very frustrated, as many do with the Poles. And then, of course, the Polish-Ukrainian war breaks out after the conference. There's a goat herd in your story, and it's also very operatic. So this is all a big question about the elephant known as the Polish question.
Mm. Okay. So the Tatra Mountain goat herds, I was really interested to find them in the Wilson papers. Again, they felt like a little bit of a discovery. There's been a tiny little bit of Polish writing about them. There's a pair of goat herds and a priest who make their way to Paris from the Tatra Mountains, from the region that's disputed between Poland and Czechoslovakia at the peace conference. We know Teschen Silesia is one of the disputed regions, and along with it, there are these small communities called Orava and Spisz that are disputed in the Tatra Mountains. And the goat herds make their way all the way to Paris to meet with Wilson to tell him that they want to live in Poland and not in Czechoslovakia. And obviously it's partly staged. There are, higher forces in play who are encouraging them to come to Paris to make this case to the president. But it's from their point of view, from the Polish point of view, a great success. The goat herds succeed in meeting with Wilson at the Hotel Crillon. The Hotel Crillon probably never saw anything like it. The Wilsonian staff who write about, who record this in their papers are all very struck by it. There's a lot of sort of discussion about, you know, what they smell like, these goat herds. And it was fascinating to me because everyone was obviously very, very ready to let these goat herds stand in for Eastern Europe and represent Eastern Europe to Paris. And the fact that they were poor, uneducated goat herds made them the perfect emblems of Eastern Europe for the peacemakers in Paris and for Wilson especially. And while Wilson enjoyed having a sense of personal friendship with another professor like himself, I'm thinking of Masaryk, or with a great artist like Paderewski, this made, you know, concrete, or rather made flesh for him, what it meant to imagine himself as a friend to the people of Eastern Europe, the implicitly backward and primitive people of Eastern Europe. These are figures who, for me, could have come out of the pages of Inventing Eastern Europe in the 18th century and were self-consciously staged to have make that impression on Wilson. And he was deeply moved by his meeting with them. And one of the things that I thought was simply amazing was on the day of the signing of the treaty, June 28th, 1919, when Wilson should have been having all kinds of anxieties and doubts about what he'd accomplished, whether this settlement was one that could last, whether the humiliation of the Germans was going to have, you know, disastrous long-term consequences, let's say in a Keynesian fashion, whether he would ever be able to make this politically viable in the United States. The one thing that's on his mind after the treaty is signed is the goat herds. And he writes to Lansing and he says, I can't believe we forgot this. Did we give them what they wanted? Are Spiš and Orava going to end up on the Polish side rather than on the Czech side? Could you look into it? And would it even be possible to fix it at this point? So that seemed to me astonishing. That would be the one anxiety on Wilson's mind in the evening of, you know, the 28th. Of June 1919. And it gives you a sense of what you just said, I think very rightly, of Wilson's massive self-confidence in what he was doing, right? I mean, overweening egotism, right? To believe that he could actually produce a settlement that would, you know, solve the problems of nationality in Eastern Europe, but I'm betrayed by just this one anxiety, which we could see again as a metonymy for a much larger set of anxieties that he might have been entertaining about the justice and workability of the settlement in terms of nationality.
Yeah, and you mentioned that there has been some psychobiographical work or psychobiographical approaches to Wilson. Do you share in this psychogeographical or psychobiographical, let's say, strategy of interpretation? You mentioned sentimental metonymy, and it seems to me much more than a lot of the biographers, you know, Arthur Link, for example, that Wilson is an extraordinarily emotional person. So is this psycho history, Larry, or how would you describe it?
I'm not totally comfortable with thinking about it as psychohistory. I'm interested in, you know, problematizing what it would mean to call it psychohistory. I am interested in Wilson's sense of self. I'm interested in how he saw his role and how he saw his mission, and that would be, you know, obviously would have psychological underpinnings. But I would, you know, probably want to insist on seeing it as an intellectual history and a cultural history. I mean, the definition of mental mapping that, you know, we've all been negotiating over, trying to understand, suggest that it would necessarily have certain psychological dimensions. That is to say, if mental maps are present in the mind, then they would have to have a certain psychological structuring. But I would be reluctant to feel that psychology is what drives the whole project.
Yeah. Is there a way that you were able to figure out Wilson's pet nations? You actually used this phrase at one point. So does it accord with Czechoslovakia, Poland, Yugoslavia? Are there exceptions? How, I mean, he is a kind of Rousseauian figure, idealizing the sort of noble savage. Would you agree with that?
He's capable of idealizing noble savages, Wilson. But I would say on the whole that his relationship to, say, Masaryk and the Czechs is not one which is about Czech savagery. He is, you know, reasonably well persuaded of that, you know, the peoples of Eastern Europe are peoples who are, you know, should have states of their own in which they are national citizens. I don't see the Wilson papers as being marked by a sense of savagery, though obviously his engagement with the goat herds places the whole thing in civilizational terms that are pretty interesting. He is interested in the idea of small nations. He's interested in the idea of new nations that require tutelage. He's interested in the ways in which Slavic peoples are connected to one another. And this comes up a couple of times in the conference discussions, in which he worries about their susceptibility to Bolshevism. That is to say, he's aware of the ethnographic and linguistic relation to the Slavic Russians. But I'm not sure I'd go so far as to see it as a relation to Eastern Europe as a realm of savages. I would say more of new nations and small nations who require a certain kind of tutelage from the great powers and older nations of the West.
Yeah. And do you think that this Masaryk conception of small nations applies to Southeastern Europe? You have a juxtaposition with Montenegro, for example. So if we go from East Central Europe to Southeastern Europe and at the intersection of the Habsburg and Ottoman defunct empires, where does Wilson's sympathy, let's say, not extend? It doesn't seem to extend to Hungary, for example, right?
So let me answer the first part first. I came into this expecting Wilson to be the worst kind of Balkanist in the ways that, say, you know, Maria Todorova has described in her book on Imagining the Balkans, and to be full of condescending perspectives on Balkan savages that come out of the world of the Balkan, the experience of the Balkan Wars. Actually, it's just not there in the record, and I wonder if it's just because Wilson somehow missed the Balkan Wars, wasn't paying attention to them. Right, they take place during the first years of his presidency, but I wonder if his attention is just focused elsewhere, because we don't actually see that marking the Wilson papers in the way that we might expect. If his condescension was going to come out anywhere, we might have expected it to come out there. So his antipathies are also very present in the papers, however, and they're not strictly a question of, you know, what we would think of as classic Western condescension towards Easterners of the kind that I write about in Inventing Eastern Europe. So no great sympathy for the Hungarians, but and the Hungarians are, of course, the big losers at the peace conference, right? They lose, more than half of the territory and population of Habsburg Hungary, which is assigned to new states, Romania, Yugoslavia, and Czechoslovakia. And the Hungarians have not forgotten that to this day. And this year is going to be the centennial of the Treaty of Trianon. And the Hungarians are still revisionists up to the present moment. However, if you look closely at the Wilson Papers, there's no great animosity towards the Hungarians in the Wilson Papers. He's even opening to listen to something about what his advisors are telling him about Hungarian sensitivity, Hungarian needs, what Hungarians want from him. There's a brief moment during the Károly government following the armistice when the Hungarians actually have high hopes of Wilson, and when it's possible to imagine a kind of Hungarian Wilsonianism. But basically the Béla Kun experience makes that impossible. Although even before the Béla Kun moment, we can see, you know, pretty clearly that Hungary's post-war neighbors are seizing upon Hungarian territories. Wilson doesn't like it. Wilson at the peace conference is angry, especially about the Romanians taking the settlement into their own hands in occupying territories of Habsburg Hungary in Transylvania. And I would say that if you looked at the Wilson Papers, unexpectedly, he's more hostile to the Romanians than he is to the Hungarians, even though the Romanians are the ones who emerge as the huge beneficiaries from the peace conference, and the Hungarians emerge as, you know, major losers in terms of territory and population. And what Wilson doesn't like about the Romanians is precisely that he sees them as grabbers. Grabber is the worst thing you can be in the Wilsonian lexicon, right? Because he's trying to, on the one hand, imagine a new diplomacy which is not about grabbing territory. And on the, I mean, that's the noblest way of envisioning it. But in a more political way of envisioning it, he believes that Paris ought to control the power, and that the peace conference itself ought to be making the crucial decisions about who gets which territories. And nations who take that into their own hands are nations that he ends up developing considerable animosity for. Becomes pretty hostile to the Italians over the course of the peace conference, believes that they are not serious about negotiating a fair national settlement with Yugoslavia in the disputed territories, becomes pretty hostile to Bulgaria over the course of the negotiations, and his very fond feelings for Poland become pretty complicated and attenuated over the course of the peace conference, right? He ultimately clings to the idea of himself as a friend of Poland, but it becomes increasingly difficult for him to do it over the peace conference. He sees say Piłsudski. He doesn't really understand Piłsudski's federalism. You referenced this earlier. He sees Piłsudski as a military man who's out to conquer territory without regard to the adjudication of the peace conference, and that always rubs Wilson the wrong way. By the time he comes to the very late period after he's left Paris, there's one moment in the papers in which he actually reflects on who are his least favorite nations in Eastern Europe. And yeah. I can't remember how he ranks them, but his hostility to the Romanians remains pretty high throughout the conference and post-conference period. And it's precisely because they're the ones who end up triumphantly in control of all the territories that they want, including vast minority populations whose rights Wilson rightly suspects the Romanians are not going to be interested in protecting or guaranteeing.
Yeah, that's interesting. And then, you know, you see from the beginning of your book, this parallel imperial understanding, the hostility toward Constantinople and Vienna, now toward the end of the Paris Peace Conference, there's almost a new racial and ethnic hierarchy of antipathy, which leaves us with the, you know, the train station in Prague where the statue of Wilson has such a fascinating history. It seems like the veneration is strongest among the Czechs or Czechs and Slovaks toward Wilson. I want to ask, since we're winding down, Larry, if you might take a minute or two and talk a little bit about your current research and in interests, or if you'd like, about the impact of this book and what you would like to see going forward.
I've been writing, as you mentioned before, I've been writing a lot about opera over the course of the last several years. Have been doing a lot of essays about opera and a fair amount of opera criticism. Wrote a whole book about opera in cultural and intellectual history, The Singing Turk. I have in mind a project about opera and the Habsburgs that would think about opera ideologically and politically in its relation to the Habsburg state and the Habsburg dynasty. I wrote a little bit about this actually in the New York Times last year in connection to the centennial production in Vienna of Richard Strauss's opera Die Frau ohne Schatten, which is about an empress in search of a shadow. It means the woman without a shadow. And I wrote about it in relation to the actual Habsburg empresses of the late 19th and early 20th century. Sisi, of course, the wife of Franz Josef, and perhaps most interestingly, Zita, the last Habsburg empress, who actually lived until 1989, and is a figure of interest to me because I participated in a small way in the Vatican consideration of her possible beatification over the course of the last decade. Thinking about opera in relation to politics and ideology is something that I would, you know, like to go on doing over the course of the coming years. And because part of my work is based in Italy right now at NYU Florence, I'm also be interested in doing more research on the Habsburgs and Italy over the course of the centuries and how we should understand Italian culture in relation to Habsburg politics and ideology. So those are both things that are on my mind as ongoing future research projects.
Well, that sounds fascinating. And I know our listeners will want to read this. I know I do. So I want to thank you, Larry, for joining me. This is Steven Siegel, your host at the New Books Network. We've been speaking with Larry Wolf. Larry's new book is Woodrow Wilson and the Reimagining of Eastern Europe, just out in 2020 with Stanford University Press. Thanks, Larry, for joining us today.
Thank you, Steven.